there. Welcome to We Need to Talk, a weekly podcast that can help empower each of us. And I'm the host, Jane Hasler, a sociologist, mental health professional, and mother of eight, seven sons and one daughter, who range in age from 15 up to 32 years. Each episode, I'll be talking with an expert on a particular social issue, from bullying to climate change, from male violence to ethical behaviour. Knowledge is power, so let's get started. This week, I'm talking with world-renowned scientist Professor Tim Flannery on climate change, in particular the urgent action Australia needs to take to help arrest global warming. Tim was the 2007 Australian of the Year and is currently the Chief Counsellor of the Climate Council. His latest book, The Climate Cure, makes clear why we need to deal with climate change as an emergency for the sake of our planet and our global community. Welcome, Tim. I'm normally a little bit nervous before interviews, but I'm actually more nervous, not because I heard you were scary to interview, to the contrary, actually, but it's such an important topic, climate change, particularly what's happening at the moment. I recently read your wonderful book, The Climate Cure, which is so accessible to read and gives you a really wonderful understanding of the situation globally and from Australia's perspective. First question, can I just ask you, you're calling it a climate emergency and you feel that the government should be approaching it as such. Can you explain further about why you believe it needs to be called that?
Yeah, sure, Jane. Look, thanks for having me on your show. It's a pleasure to be here. Look, I think emergencies, often people think of them as, oh, you know, it's like happening right now. It's sort of, you know, we have to, you know, it's happening in front of our eyes. And that's true to some extent with climate change. But the reason I call it an emergency is that if we don't act now, we'll be in a very serious situation down the road. It's a bit like, you know, you can imagine going to the doctor, you've eaten nothing but meat pies and drank nothing but beer for 40 years. You smoke three packs of cigarettes a day. You're still feeling okay. You go to the doctor and say, look, your system's about to break down, you know, and you say, yeah, but I'm feeling all right. He said, no, you've really got to do something now before you start to have the heart attack, you know.
Yes.
Climate change is an emergency in that sense, that we have to act now if we want to avoid really serious consequences in the future. We're already having some consequences now, but they get much more serious and you get committed to them by your past. You know, a bit like that eating meat pies and drinking beer for 40 years, that commits you to a certain outcome unless you can change.
Yes. That's right. And what we're seeing in the world at the moment with floods and the mega fires that we had in 2020, that's a result of not taking the action, correct, that we have been needing to take for quite a while.
Well, that's right. The kind of the foundations of those catastrophic climate events, you know, were starting to be laid decades ago when we didn't take notice of what the scientists were saying. And sadly, Jane, we've added so much greenhouse gas in recent years. Like, I was made Australian of the Year in 2007. And since then, humanity has added about 25 to 30% of all of the greenhouse gases we've ever added in our million-year history.
Wow.
To the atmosphere, just in those few years. Yeah, so you can see how the problem is building up and we haven't reacted fast enough.
And why do you think that is so, Tim? Particularly here in Australia, what do you think's been the main issue here in Australia with us not reacting?
Well, we sort of encapsulate the dilemma beautifully here in Australia. You know, we're the world's largest exporter by coal, if you look at it through calorific value, I mean the energy value of the coal, and we're the world's largest exporter of natural gas. So, you know, we've done pretty well out of the fossil fuel era, and it's very hard for anyone to move away from something that's served them well, even if they can see that the consequences are going to be quite severe into the future. And, you know, that situation has been exacerbated really by the fossil fuel industry, which has spent a lot of money trying to stop people from being properly informed. It's spent money on trying to influence government policy and so forth. So we've been in a difficult position. You know, you can see at some levels of government, we've done pretty well, like at the council level and the state level, increasingly we've done okay. But at the federal level, we're still really failing.
Now, in your book, you say there's a number of people in government that are holding the government to ransom because of their best interests or their concerns about the coal industry. But you say it might be their own interests that they're concerned about. Many do go into the industry when they leave politics. Is that right?
Well, that's right. I mean, we've had ministers, for energy, but go from being a minister in the government to being either, you know, head of a lobby group, fossil fuel lobby group, or onto the board of a fossil fuel company. And that holds for both sides of politics. So there's a sort of a capture by the industry of political leadership in this area that is really, really unfortunate. And, you know, I think it was Bob Bork that said, you know, in a horse race, always back self-interest. Yeah. And, you know, that's unfortunately...
Yes.
In this case, it's all too true.
but the argument that is used by a number of people in government saying we need to look at the cost to the electorates, but the cost really is the planet. The jury's come back on what the cost is. It's the planet, it's our global population. So we need to be ensuring that those coal-focused electorates, where there is a lot of the mining still going on, their concerns are alleviated through the government saying that we need what they've had in Germany, correct? And 50 other countries where you've actually had a group of people getting together and saying this will make the transition easy for you because you won't be missing out on income
and you'll be swapping over into a job in renewables.
What's your comment on that?
Well, look, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, you know, the economy is never static, is it? You know, I'm old enough, Jane, to remember an Australia that rode on a sheep's back, you know,
yeah.
And like wool today is nowhere near it is. And you know, we survived that and people adjusted and so forth. And then we had that we've had the minerals boom that's taken, you know, iron ore and so forth that served us well. But even that's not going to go on forever. And particularly that's true for the fossil fuels. And, you know, societies that work together to overcome the problems that presents. So the really successful societies on Earth, the enduring ones, you know,
yep.
We have to make sure that we help each other through this. This is not a battle between coal workers and greenies or anything like that. It's a battle of all Australians for a better future for us and our children. And we need to work together with some real generosity and empathy to achieve that.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. It's a working together, isn't it? And it shouldn't be a partisan situation, should it? It should be across all parliament saying we need to make that difference, like it has been in other countries.
Yeah, and look, people misunderstand the nature of the coal industry. I mean, in this day and age, you know, it's a highly technologically sophisticated business with a relatively small workforce that's extremely well paid and very, very specialised and very proud of their skills, you know, highly skillful. So we've got to recognise that and then think, well, how do we then, in light of that, adjust? And how do we bring those communities along with us? Because it's the coal industries, they're very localised around, and obviously, the mining areas.
Yep.
So we have to have a careful dialogue, and it needs in some ways to be led by those communities. You know, what's holding us back at the moment is that dreadful political voice that says, you know, if you haven't got coal, you've got nothing, you know.
Yep.
And it's a lie that is designed to keep those committees hostage to a few political ideologues. And we have to break through that.
Yep, yep. And we can break through it by people saying that we will support you, people in government saying we will support these areas with, say, a national transition authority that was set up in Germany. And essentially, that's what we do need. The Next Economy talks about it. Amanda Carl, you probably know her, that it's really all about alleviating those concerns. Research has actually found that in a lot of those electorates, people actually want to hop over into a renewable job. They're not attached to a coal job. They're attached to a job.
Yeah, and look at those. It's got a few names, but I know it as the coal compromise. And compromise is the important word there because nobody in politics ever gets everything of what they want.
Yes.
So it's what we can live with, you know, and we And in that coal compromise, a large amount of money went to the coal industries, the polluting industries.
Mm.
And a lot went to communities, and we all agree that was a great thing. But, you know, it perhaps if you were an ideologue at either end, you wouldn't have been entirely happy with that compromise. But that's where we need to go. Mm. We need to have that genuine dialogue. It needs to be community-led and facilitated. And it needs to be, well, first of all, the underlying platform is a realization that the fossil fuel industry is not going to go on forever.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where government, you know, needs to lead. We need to hear from our major political parties that they know that transition is inevitable, and we're going to do this in a way that has the least impact, deleterious impact, upon the affected communities.
Mm. We've seen some very good documentaries that point out where there's been a successful transition to renewables. They've said, we don't understand Australia still mining coal because there won't be an industry happening in 10 to 15 years in many other countries. So there won't be the imports from Australia for coal and gas. So we need to be thinking about the future from a fiscal perspective as well. I mean, economically, it makes a lot more sense too, doesn't it?
It does. It's interesting the way people view this stuff, though. I had a friend who worked in his early days in the US automobile industry. He then went into energy, but he said he was asked, this must have been the 70s, he was asked by Ford to do a survey of the penetration of foreign brands, non-US brands, into the US car market. And he was based in Detroit, right, with all of these
mm-hmm.
people.
Yep.
And so he produced this map showing that in the 50s there was a few European vehicles coming into the East Coast and a few Japanese into the West Coast. And in the 60s there was more. 70s they'd really penetrated, but there was still this area around Detroit where there were mostly American vehicles. And so he presented this to his boss, and his boss just looked out the window and said, well, I don't see a problem out there on the streets of Detroit. Dismissed. And some people are like that. They don't, you know, they don't want to see the growing threat. So, you know, I think there's a number of people who are leaders in the fossil fuel industry in Australia today who are in that position. They've made their fortunes on fossil fuel. It's all they understand. They can't see a future for them outside that. And why would you change?
So it really is up to the government and the communities to inform the electorates and the people and say, this is where we need to go. Have you felt heartened about the recent polling throughout Australia that showed in every electorate the majority of people do want more action on climate change? Have you been heartened by that?
Look, I have been heartened by it. I guess what I see, though, is that we're really in a race, Jane, now. So even if we make the transition but don't make it fast enough, we'll still lose, if you know what I mean, because there are these climatic tipping points that once triggered, it means kind of game over, really, you know, in a sense of trying to prevent this catastrophic change. So, yes, it's good, but we have to always measure it up against the reality. And I think our Prime Minister said about the virus, you know, the virus makes its own rules. Sadly, the climate system does exactly the same thing. It makes its own rules. So any plans we have about getting there by 2050 or whatever looks to be practicable from our economic perspective.
Yes.
Really, that's a secondary consideration. You've got to play by the rules of the system and make those changes in time to avoid a catastrophe.
Yep. So the Paris Agreement in 2015 said that we want to keep our warming but well below, preferably, 2 degrees against pre-industrial temperatures. And they're trying to keep it at 1.5, but it's looking like it might be between the 1.5 and 2 degrees. Now, in order to keep it at that and meet zero emissions by 2050, we need to set a reduction target by 2030, as many other countries are proposing. Our government here at the moment won't even say they'll commit to a 2050 target. The opposition, Labor, are. So do you think that we also need to set a target by 2030?
Yeah, look, we need to have the great majority of our industry decarbonised by between 2030 and 2035 to have a chance. And look, could I just outline where we are with this, Jane? It's so much greenhouse gas has gone into the air and continues to go into the air that the best outcome we can hope for at the moment, it appears, is stabilising the temperature at about 1.7 to 1.8 degrees above the pre-industrial average And that carries with it considerable risk and considerable downside. One option that people are looking at is saying, well, let's try to do that, but then let's try to get some of the gas out of the air so that we can stabilize a decade or two after that at, say, 1.5 degrees. Now, that is a monumental undertaking. It is possible, but it's a monumental undertaking. And I think that, you know, we need governments that look holistically at this problem. We need them to say, yes, let's set a target for decarbonisation that will get us there in time so we don't go through 2 degrees. So 2030 to 2035 is about where that is, you know. And that's very, very soon. It's really soon, you know.
Sure is.
And so, but then let's make sure that all of the consequences of our past inaction are catered for. So we are going to see heat waves, we're going to see bushfires, we're going to see rising seas, all of which will have costs and have the potential to stress our society to breaking point. So we need to say, how are we going to adapt? We've got a limited pool of funds. Let's see how we're going to sit down and use this pool of funds most effectively to minimise the harm that's already in train. And that's a big job for government. It's really, you know, a major, major undertaking. And thirdly, we've got to say, well, how do we get some of the gas out of the air? Do we use silicate rocks? Do we use Australia's mining expertise to do this? Do we use seaweed farms to do it? Do we use direct air capture? You know, there's a whole lot of options out there, but we need to start thinking very seriously about how we do that and how we finance it. So the climate issue, it's not just about the emissions reductions. It's a holistic problem that government must face, because if we don't, at each one of those steps, if we fail at any one of those three steps, we could endanger the stability of our civilization.
Mm. Yes, because it isn't just about reducing the emissions, is it, Tim? It is about capturing and storing, sequestering what's already there from what occurred 20-odd years ago or 30-odd years ago. That's correct?
Well, from my grandmother's, you know, briquette stove, it's still up there, half of it. It is. It's still there. So, you know, this is the tragedy of the greenhouse gases. They keep on accumulating. You know?
Yep. I read the wonderful report by the Climate Council, Aim High, Go Fast, and I suggest everybody gets online and reads that. And they talk about how instead of looking at 2050, we need to be looking even at 2040 and to be aiming for that rather than zero emissions by 2050. Is that correct? And what would you like to see happen with the COP, which stands for the Conference of Parties, COP26, in November in Glasgow? What would you like to see happen?
Well, look, I would like to see the reality of climate change be reflected in the political decision making, you know. And if we just return to Australia for that, Jane, we can see there's a few things which can be done very quickly. So the first is decarbonising electricity grid, right? There's no reason why we in Australia couldn't have a totally green grid, maybe with a tiny bit of gas, but that's going to be largely irrelevancy by 2026. We could do that. We could build the infrastructure. We could have everything in place if we focused on that. And then for transport, we could be like some of the Scandinavian countries, you know, have a very proactive electric vehicle uptake. And we could have we could be well on the way to decarbonising transport by 2030. And in terms of our industries, if we invested correctly in those, say steelmaking, cement making and so forth, we could have the industrial processes reformed to be largely carbon negative or carbon neutral by 2035. So that's the kind of thing we need to do. Take the low-hanging fruit and move onwards through the process with a deliberative government plan that doesn't waste money, doesn't waste time, but gets on with the job to hand, recognises the magnitude and gets on with the job to hand. So that's what we need in terms of decarbonisation. I'd love to see that sort of thing reflected through the COP process. When it comes to protecting people from the effects of climate change, we really need a commission of some sort to look at what are the most cost-effective things we do. You know, just as an example, Jane, New Zealand's got an earthquake insurance scheme, which says that I forget how much now, it might be 20 cents in every $100 that's invested in insurance goes into a fund to protect against the inevitable earthquake. Well, Australia could have a fund like that for protecting against sea level rise, you know, for the building of the necessary infrastructure, for helping to assist people where they have to abandon coastal properties and so forth and building infrastructure further inland. So, you know, that's just one little thing in adaptation, but we could be looking at that. We could be looking at the resilience of our fire emergency services? Are we in a position to do that? How do we do it cost effectively? You know, what are the regulations that would give us the best opportunity to avoid deaths in heat waves in our major cities? You know, do we need more green spaces? Do we need more light roofs? Do we need light road surfaces? But all of this sort of stuff could be brought into the purview of government, where you have a direction which starts getting you on a sustainable pathway where we have least damage. And, you know, when it comes to the drawdown, getting the gas out of the air, we should be saying, well, what is Australia's capacity to use silicate rocks to draw down? What are the costs involved? What role could our current mining industry play in that? You know, what might the impacts on agriculture be? Will we get an increase in yield, which is what you do get when you spread these rocks on? So we need that focus, Jane, right across the board. We are acting so inadequately at the moment. It's almost as if we're just hiding our head in the sands.
We should be the opposite, Tim, shouldn't we? We should be a world leader in climate action. We've got the solar, we've got the wind, we've got the battery prowess.
We've got the minerals, we've got everything. Absolutely, we've got the space. We have got absolutely everything. And we've got a good system of government that, you know, used properly could really assist us to get through this crisis. But we're not doing that. I find it very hard to understand. I think, you know, we're a frontier society in some ways, Jane, and we have got a libertarian streak in us that, you know, people say, don't tell me what to do, don't tell me how to think, and that's fair enough. But when you come to a crisis like this, we do have to work together to get anywhere.
Mm. And that's good leadership, isn't it, Tim, to really inform people and say, this is for your benefit. Even though people aren't understanding it, say in some of the electorates where it's the focus on fossil fuels as their main earner, we need to be saying that this transition is a real positive for you and your community. But it needs to be changed throughout Australia for the global good and for our good. What do you say about that argument? Well, we only emit less than 2% of the world's carbon emissions. However, I've read that the total of every country that emit less than 2% is over 60% of global carbon emissions. Imagine if we all said, well, we're not going to try. Imagine what an impact that would be. So it's not how much, it shouldn't be in regards to how much you emit. It should be that you're contributing to the whole. And we each need to set an example and do what we can to reduce emissions.
Jane, let's take that argument a bit further. Let's say during the Second World War, the percentage of Allied troops that came out of Australia and New Zealand was about 1.4%. And imagine if the Prime Minister had got up and said, look, we're only 1.4% of the force, guys. It doesn't matter what you do. Just slack off. You know, just stay in the back. You know, that yes. would be treason, right?
Absolutely. And,
so the argument is rubbish, total rubbish. We all have to do our part. We all know that we're facing a serious problem, and we know we can do our part and continue to thrive. So just shirking responsibility like that is rubbish. And I was deeply ashamed of our Prime Minister when he spouted that rubbish. And I thought someone from the Army needed to point out, you know, if he'd said the same thing during the First or the Second World Wars, it would have been treasonous.
Yes, that's a great analogy, Tim. You use the analogy in your book, The Climate Cure, how the way we need to address the climate emergency should be the way we address the pandemic. Jump up, do something about it. I mean, now that it's 9 months later from when your book was published, we can even have a further analogy showing the slowness of the rollout and the issues with quarantine. Look what that has caused. And it would have been much better to have had a faster approach to the vaccine rollout. So this is what can happen if you don't take action. We end up in a far worse position later on.
Well, it turns out that it was a race, you know.
Yeah.
And it is with climate too. And the one thing we've learned with the pandemic is that inaction or inadequate action pre-commits you to certain outcomes. So it's you can see it coming. It's like a slow motion wreck. Mm-hmm. You can see week after week the consequences that you cannot rectify then. You can't undo them. So that inaction early on still haunts us. And I think it really is a lesson to us all that we need to take these issues seriously.
I saw a wonderful interview at the Wheeler Centre in Melbourne, and Izzy, a 13-year-old girl, interviewed you for half an hour soon after your book came out. She was wonderful. Her answers to you, her questions. Why do you think it is that so many of our youth seem to be getting it right in relation to their advocacy around climate change, and a lot of our more mature people, our older community, are more hesitant and are their answers are more complex? Why do you think the youth seem to be leading the way in many areas around climate change?
Well, that's such a great question, Jane, and so profound, really. You know, I think that older generations had a very tough time of it. You know, my parents' generation, they were born in the middle of the Depression. They were in the war. They lived through a very, very tough time in Australia and globally, for that matter, where it was, you know, people were desperate just for a roof over their head and, food in the house. It wasn't always sustainable. So if you grow up in that sort of world with really immediate needs, you often put off, you know, the longer term. Like that generation as well, were particularly the men, were not great for going to the doctor, you know.
Yes, that's true. Right? Yeah.
And that's their own health, right? But they, you know, the urgency of stuff was a different mindset, right?
Yep.
So I think that's part of it. That is part of the change. Part of it is, of course, that the kids can see their whole future laid out being compromised as well, whereas those older people, they've lived the best of their life. And, you know, there's a certain selfishness, I guess, in some that says, oh, well, that's good enough, you know?
Yep.
And the third thing, I think, is that those children are very well educated, particularly in environmental matters relative to earlier generations. So, and of course, they're optimistic. They're young, and it's wonderful to see. So,
yeah, you know, it is.
So all of that counts.
It certainly does. So, you know, this argument that they need to be in school learning rather than rallying for action for climate change is really ridiculous, isn't it? Because what they're doing is so good for their education and knowledge.
Well, exactly. It's yes, I can think of a few people who should be probably in school learning, but they're not the kids.
That's right. I'm wondering too, Tim, if it's particularly when we look at people in politics who've been putting up barricades to the action, they have other issues, other concerns, as we talked about earlier, that it might affect themselves individually, personally, rather than looking at the global good.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, yeah. And yeah, look, and a lot of those people, they are hardened, aren't they? You see it in the way they talk. They're not tremendously empathetic often. They're very much caught up in their own combative world of politics or whatever it happens to be. And, you know, that's increasingly out of step with what we need with leaders. I mean, you mentioned earlier, Jane, leadership, you know, and my experience of leadership comes at its greatest really through meeting the great Melanesian leaders, you know, in New Guinea, in the Solomon Islands and West Papua and Aboriginal communities. And leaders in those communities are not like supposed leaders in our society. They never dictate anything, right? Because they're living in societies where everyone has a degree of autonomy. You know, I remember speaking to one global leader that I was working with, a Solomon Islands leader who I was trying to get a community conservation project up with. And he was telling me that to do this, he has to first make peace. And so, you know, you can imagine a situation where there's two little family groups living isolated in the bush. The youth all come together in a, you know, perhaps the local town. One of them loses a game of pool or game of cards and stabs the other one and kills him, right? So then you've got to walk into that village to try to make peace, right? And there's the father and the mother and the uncle and everyone. And, you know, you're shaking, you're terrified. But that is leadership. Right. That's leadership to put yourself on the line and go and do that. And those people, when they're building community consensus, never put their own views first. They convene meetings. They talk about the goals and then they let the discussion organically come around to the points that it needs to come to, which they kind of then can direct and guide and foster. So everyone feels a winner, you know. The people who are just like megaphones up there, you know, they're parodies. They're not leaders. They know nothing really about the politics of humanity, and it's really sad to see. And I think we need a different kind of leadership, particularly in this era of climate change.
And we need to care about the world and our neighbours. I mean, look at the Pacific Islands. They were very disappointed about the lack of action that the Australian government took in relation to how it's affecting them. And they're very, very concerned with the rising sea levels, which is totally understandable. So we need to be looking at our neighbours and the rest of the world, not just ourselves, don't we?
Well, you do. There is no, I mean, you know, nothing happens in isolation. And, you know, it's one of the tragedies of the of this, I guess, Australia's view that our Pacific neighbours are kind of hardened to seeing us as selfish people. It's really quite
sad. That's sad, isn't it?
You know, Brian Fisher, who was head of ABARE and who's been spoken about recently in terms of how much it's going to cost to do anything about climate change, you know, at a Pacific Islands conference in the late 80s, early 90s, he just said, look, it'd be cheaper for the Pacific Islands to go underwater than it would be for Australia to get rid of its coal-fired power plants.
Oh, what a thing to say.
Yeah, in a meeting. I mean, you know, that's kind of like, what is that? It's kind of not, certainly not leadership.
No way. Because good leadership is all about sending the right message too, sending the message that we care about our other, our neighbours, about the world, about ourselves, about everybody in the community. And that's good leadership. Yeah. So just wanting to talk to you, Tim, about the IPCC report,
which is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report,
recently released. That's released every 6 years, is my understanding. Was anything in that, did any of it surprise you? I guess it didn't.
No, look, I keep a pretty close eye on all of that stuff, Jane. So it didn't surprise me. But, you know, it was a very poignant moment for me because I realised it's probably the last warning that we'll get from the scientists, big warning of that nature, before it's too late. You know, those reports come out once every 7 or 8 years. And if we don't take heed of this one, then by the time the next one's due, I think it's going to be, you know, we may well be facing the cliff.
Wow. Wow. So we really, it's good timing in a way, isn't it, that we've had that, and hopefully the government will take heed. Scott Morrison, coming back to him being the Prime Minister, the buck stops with him, doesn't it, in what he has to say with what he goes to Glasgow with for the COP26. We need to be seeing real targets there, and Australia's starting to turn around and show that we're a leader. We do need to make an about face, don't we?
We do, and we have done it before. I've been to quite a number of COPs, and I remember when the Gillard government was elected, just what a massive breath of fresh air that was for the things. And people do forgive. They forgive countries that have been obstructions the whole time and welcome you into the fold. It's the only way forward, you know. Like Cristiana Figueres, you know, the UN Secretary General for Climate, was saying, you know, that it's got to be a win-win for everyone. But, you know, for that to happen, everyone has to see the what pathway through to being it being a win-win.
Yep, that's right. They don't really care about what's gone before. They're caring about what they're hearing now.
That's right.
And how we're moving forward.
Yeah.
And just going back before we finish up, Tim, we're looking at solar power. I mean, solar power, wind power, will end up a lot cheaper than our current fossil fuel power that people are paying for. That's correct, isn't it?
It already is cheaper. It already is cheaper. You know, solar power is what the whole planet's run on for the last 4 billion years. So
yeah.
You know, there's plenty of it.
That's right. I mean, we've got no excuse in Australia, have we, with our sunshine, our wind?
No, it's crazy. No, we should be, like I said, give us 5 years and a determined government, we could transition entirely away from fossil fuels for energy and be in a better position. We'd have better health outcomes. We'd have, you know, less cost in the health system. We'd have more distributed and more equitable energy systems and cheaper energy systems and more reliable energy systems. So we've just got to get the old fossil fuel clunkers out of the way and we'd have that. And to do that, we have to treat communities fairly and equitably.
And finally, Tim, is there anything you'd like to finish with? Is there something that you feel you just want to say overall in relation to our situation here in Australia and climate change and taking action?
Look, I'd just like to say that this is really the moment for action. If you're thinking about things, you're concerned about things, this is the moment to reach out to your community and say, what can we do? None of us have got all the answers, but there are plenty of people out there with a lot of experience and know how to act. I mean, and that you might be going to your local school to get solar panels put on the school or whatever, or you might be starting a Voices of campaign to get more climate-aware politicians into parliament. Whatever it is, this is the moment for action for that. Don't leave it 10 years. By 10 years' time, it's going to be too late. In the likelihood, we have to make big progress this decade.
Well, that's a perfect way to finish our discussion. And we need to be having a lot more discussions about taking action. And that's what it's all about, isn't it? And thank you so much, Tim, for your expert opinions about this based on facts and the evidence. And nobody can argue the evidence isn't out there, can we?
No, unfortunately. The climate system doesn't particularly care about us as individuals, but we suffer the consequences of disturbing it.
That's true. Thanks so much for your time today, Tim. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Jane.
Next episode, I'm talking with Dr. Amanda Carl, founder of The Next Economy here in Australia. Amanda started this organisation in 2018 after witnessing the increasing fear in regional communities about how to stay financially afloat in a changing workforce, particularly in relation to vital climate change action. We talk fear, national identity, and real solutions to this issue. Until then, take care of yourselves and each other, and remember, knowledge is power.